WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Robert Klein, one of the forerunners of the current comedy boom. Comedian Robert Klein developed a national following with his first album, released in 1973, Child of the 50s.
I'm not fond of the 50s. Civil defense was heavy then. I don't know if you remember this, but this was like an overriding concern. They spent so much time talking about it that I had nightmares. I cared. First of all, they were very subtle. They told us, children, the siren means disaster. Dream about them often. When you hear a siren, go under a tree. Give up. It's too terrible. Don't even try to save yourself. It's just take this pill. You know. They taught us a siren means disaster. Then they had the foresight to blow a siren every day at 12 o'clock. Walking home from school with a lunch bag. What's that? Oh, it's just 12 o'clock. Oh, you know. I used to second guess, what if the Russians bombed at 12 o'clock? They're not idiots.
We'll bomb at 12 o'clock, Ivan. They don't know. They think it's lunch.
Robert Klein's treatment of growing up in the 50s gave him the reputation of being one of the leading comedic voices of the baby boom generation. But his numerous appearances on The Tonight Show and his subsequent bookings at top nightclubs around the country have won him a much broader audience. Early in his development, Klein refined his writing and performance style, working with the improvisational comedy group Second City. This opened the door to roles on Broadway and in movies. Robert Klein grew up in the Bronx. He told me that he was introduced to stand-up comedy by television and through the nightclubs in the Borscht Belt, the circuit of Catskill Mountain resort hotels that catered to a largely Jewish clientele.
I always paid attention to the comedians on television, and in the opportunities that I had working in the so-called Borscht Belt as a lifeguard, a day camp counselor, a busboy, I would pretty much pay attention to those small-time Saturday night shows when they'd have a roller skating team open and have some poor singer who works in the A&P during the week, Italian boy from Philadelphia who panders with Jewish songs, and black acts that sing My Yiddish Mama and use the word Schwarze. And, the comedians were always intriguing to me. I tell you know, two bald-headed men, you put your heads together, you make an ass of yourself, you know, that sort of thing. I think it is a remarkable art that is in one stand-up comedian. It's peculiarly American. It's probably basically a post-war phenomenon. There's very little written about it. Last Laugh by Phil Berger. Steve Allen attempted to write something about it. It's more than just music hall with a song and all that. It's a guy standing there for a while, you know.
Was there a kind of comedian you were determined to not become?
What I didn't want to be was just a guy who did fat girlfriend jokes and this and that. Like, Henny Youngman is wonderful. He's wonderful. But I didn't want to be like Henny Youngman. I wanted to say things. I wanted to be conceptual, subtle, and yet I love silliness too, intelligent, bring my education to bear, bring the language to bear, which I think very few comedians do.
When you started performing, I think you were performing in New York initially in folk clubs. Did the folk audience have an interest in comedians, or were the comedians seen as just the frivolous stuff till you got to the real, you know, political and folk music?
When I began trying out, I was a substitute teacher. I was out of Yale Graduate School for Drama, feeling really low in the fall of 63. No real prospects. I left graduate school after a year. I'm out of school for the first time in my life. My father has reminded me, too, that he spent a lot of money for an education. What do I know? History, political science major, graduate school in drama. I started substitute teaching. And while I was substitute teaching, I had the courage, it took a lot of guts, some months later, to go down to what they called Hoot Nanny Night in Greenwich Village, Café Wa, the bitter end. And one week, night a week, when the regular performer wasn't performing, they were dark, they would have a kind of tryout night, which they called Hootenanny. The very name itself implies music. As a matter of fact, when I went down there, there were 10 singers to every one comedian. It was a lot of people tuning, and I like, Michael Rowe, ka-plunk, your boat, ka-plunk, ashore, ka-plunk. And, you know, a lot of coffee being ordered, and berets, and that sort of thing. And I did well a few nights. And then I began doing poorly. And I didn't know why, because I didn't have the expertise. No. Second City busted everything out.
What did you learn from Second City that you think you might not have ever figured out on your own?
Well, first of all, I learned a true method for improvisation. Before, I would rely on my crazy and very quick head going and developing things. And Paul Sills, the original director at Second City, whose mother wrote the book called Improvisation for the Theater. Her name is Viola Spolin. Very simply, it's this. I'm facing you across a table. Our radio listeners can't see that, but... if I were to do an improvisation with you, the worst thing an improviser can do is what he calls playwright. That is, I have a brother back in Tennessee and blah, blah, blah. My brother in Tennessee isn't relevant here. You are. The color of your reddish hair, your tweed jacket, the way your hands are clasped under your chin could be the key to the scene because it's now. I'm looking at you, I'm listening to you, and vice versa. And if you have to, make a ball, take it from a shelf, mime it. Maybe the scene will be in that ball. But the immediacy of improvisation is the key. And that's exactly how I write all my material. Except more and more I'm pre-writing. I think of an idea, write it down, and develop it and decide to try it that night. But most of the stuff has been kind of exploded out of me, like a jazz musician, a thing that inspires that. It's almost another person doing it. It happens. And it's recorded either on a tape or my pianist or I remember at the end and develop it. And so Second City gave me that discipline that when I tried stand-up next at the improvisation, it gave me an overall method, a discipline for creating comedy and comedy ideas and the invaluable toning and sharpening of my performance skills under excellent directors. Every night I had to perform set sketches and then improvise in a session immediately after that.
What would you do if you would flop when you were on stage? On those nights when you didn't get the response that you wanted?
It is pretty horrendous to stand there and bomb. And I was so determined that I didn't want to have that feeling that I made certain pretty early on that I would keep on my toes. Number one, I've written so much material, so if something isn't working, pull right out of it into something else that the audience wouldn't even know. Number two, I always improvise things, think of new things. They happen to me, the room, the environment. Number three, I have a performance poise and a technique developed over the years so that I don't bail out after the... You watch a kid on The Tonight Show, first two jokes don't work, and that's hard because it's only 6 minutes. You don't have over an hour to spend with these folks. And right away you can see, if you look very carefully, it just he begins apologizing for the rest of the material. So the only way you can combat that is with technique. And it just is, as awful as it seems, it is a ridiculous kind of situation to be in.
In the late 60s and early 70s, everyone of the baby boom generation, I think, wanted to be like a bohemian or an activist of some sort or something. And it was considered very unhip to be middle class, to be a Jewish middle class person from New York. You know, you were from the Bronx. Did you ever play that up and make it seem like you were really, really tough because you were from the Bronx?
Well, of course, a real dullard would take me for someone who was brought up tough. You know, my parents, watch out for that lamp cord. You're going out at night, wear white colors, you know. My parents wait an hour after you eat before you go in swimming. You will die like that boy on Hull Avenue did, you know. My parents had a different approach to child rearing than, say, the Flying Willenders. I would hardly could do the toughness angle. But, you see, I was very, very... I wanted to combine... You're quite right about that, people wanting to be bohemian, or how at least my friends and I were so above it all. We were rather snobbish. Thought everyone was the squarest thing in life. We called them blanderts. The rest of the world was all bland, and we were the funny ones. We giggled. I think there was a kind of rebellion against the Jewish heritage a little. In my house, I didn't get a very strict Jewish upbringing at all, but the consciousness of being Jewish you know, it's obviously a very integral part of our upbringing. I was brought up in a neighborhood where there were not only Jews, but certainly there were a lot of them. And these are people, my parents were born in New York. They're the first generation, though, from Hungary. And one set that came in 1882 and the other set in 1899. It was very important to me when I went into show business not to change my name. Extremely important. Robert Kay, Robert Kellogg, Robert, you know. I didn't want to. That was very important.
Well, when you started performing, I think you were performing to an audience that in part defined itself as being countercultural, being like outside of the mainstream and different from what you were going to tune in on television that mm-hmm. night. But do you think that audience has changed as they've gotten older and as they've become more assimilated into the mainstream or more defined what the mainstream is?
I think the audience has changed, and I have too, floated right along. It's a very good point, countercultural. The first approach was when I did, for example, Las Vegas with Barbara Streisand. I had a terrible experience, especially New Year's Eve when people yelled out drunk and all that. Barbara was great. I mean, I had no problem with her, but, hey, North Carolina, you know, $35 a ticket in 1972. And I said to myself, I never wanted to do this cufflink stuff, you know. Colleges, man, and then I made three albums in a row, 73, 74, 75, and I performed in a lot of college gyms, and I let my hair grow. And what I like now is that as my work gets better and better, it becomes also more and more truthful. I don't have to pretend to be anybody. And the actual thing that I dreamt of is only a possibility many years ago is true now. That is that I can go to Utah, to University of Utah, and there's a Robert Klein performance, and people come, and I am the Bronx Jew who I am. It's so unfair, actually. It's almost like I'm trying to shock the Bronx Jew. It's not only what I am, but I am a New York, urban, educated, certainly Jewish man. I don't have to change my speech. I don't have to change much. And they understand the universalities from Alaska to Utah to Texas to Maine to the Bronx.
I guess it's Robert Klein, if you're just joining us. Can I ask you how you originated that eerie, scary, ooey sound that you do?
It stems from, I think my parents, as a father myself, I'd like to raise my child, and maybe I hope we have another one, to be a little more intrepid, at least in childhood. Everyone is scared of certain things. And I think I just took a movie cliche. Probably somebody once wrote me a long letter, which was the first movie ever to use it. But I'm imitating an electronic instrument called a theremin. Right? And so I just began to write bits, which I haven't done in a long time. I think they're from on my last album, New Teeth, about what I call the scary woo-woo. I think it was a combination of something, childhood fears, and then take that scary noise and then put it on adult fears. And, you know, when I made the observation that people are so crazy about animals, I mean crazy about animals, look at the absolute unspeakable catastrophes happening to children throughout the world through starvation, through violence, murder. Some people try to torture a couple of kids in Brooklyn the other day and some dope murder and all this. And yet, if someone throws a dart into a cage at the San Diego Zoo, it makes front page and people go, what is this world coming to? You know, and all that. I said, people loading other people into concentration camps going, Ich steigen die Juden! Oh, a puppy. Hans, look, we take it, you know. And then I would go, my comment on that remark. That's how I guess I've been using it. I haven't done it as much lately.
I bet, though, that you hear a lot of people walking around doing it.
Yes, I have never, again, going against convention, I would have been smart to perhaps have some sort of hook, like Rodney Dangerfield has no respect, that wonderful thing, which he, believe me, worked very hard on for the years that he worked. I mean, for a while, people thought it was saddle shoes because I wore them a lot. Other people think it's woo-woo, you know. A lot of people say, I can't stop my leg on the street. I would imagine that more people around the country and the North American continent have stopped me or said, woo, some bad imitations of theremins than any other single hook, but I never intended it to be that way.
You're a father now, right? Has the perspective of your humor, the point of view, changed from the point of view of I remember when I was a child to now that I'm a parent? You know, have you changed from, like, child jokes to parent jokes?
Well, one of the things I talk about in material is to, first of all, to give my parents credit. My father died not too long ago. My mother is an incredibly spunky 76-year-old woman, plays a great stride piano and all that. I think they tried very hard. I think they made several mistakes, particularly my father was too harsh in certain areas or perhaps insensitive in others, but he tried. I think it's just plain intelligence to learn from what you perceive as the mistakes of your parents. Like my friend Al Uger, who's a writer-producer, is my best friend in California. He has two sons. He said, what I try to think, what would I have wanted my father to do in this situation? As far as tutu, pupu, and embarrassment and all that, using euphemisms for things like that, I think the times have taken care of that pretty much. So that there's nothing, I mean, we're not going to have a 1940s attitude about parts of the body. And yet certain things don't change. Certain kinds of conventions, certain feelings between parent and child, I already know, looking at my very advanced 15-month-old, but he's still dumb, and I know more. And I can see this 10 years from now. I'm going to know a lot more about a certain issue or thing. But this kid is becoming a human now. No more bawling little ball, you know. Actually, he didn't bawl that much. You suddenly realize this is more than a flower. It's more than a Cocker Spaniel. This is a whole human, a whole gizmo. And he has to have his freedom and say so.
Are there places in New York you go to hang out just to watch crazy people behave in the hopes of maybe finding something you'd want to use in some material for something that you're writing?
I can't say that I ever actually go out specifically to do that, no. I really don't have to go to a place to see funny people. They are situations are all around me every moment. And if you turn on the radio or watch television, they're there too. It's just, you read the newspaper, it's there. My particular talent is taking what everyone else sees and making it into coherent comedy. Other people's talent is to take what they see and draw it. But that's my talent.
Do people come up to you when you're in a restaurant or something and try to show off how funny they are?
Yes, it's one of the standard kind of immature things. Someone, let me tell you a joke. That's one that amazes me. And always people say, you can use this in your routine, and which is I smile at it because it's meant gracefully, but it really is denigrating in the sense I think it's just so uncomplicated as that. Oh, if someone will tell me a good story, I'll use it. Well, there's some other comedians who do that, but not Robert Klein, you know. Here's something that happened. I must tell you this. I get a lot of that. At a college level again, hey, George Carlin, hey, Steve Martin. But don't you think Steve Martin and George Carlin told me people say, hey, Robert Klein, something. They're trying to show their affection by being irreverent, by being impertinent, really. Some cretinous ones like, hey, you're feeling, Julian Lennon, well, I wouldn't call it cretinous, but the young man didn't know quite what to say at Night of 100 Stars. He said, you're partially funny some of the time. Said, that's a nice thing to say, Julian. I'm twice your age. Yeah. Some people don't know how to be graceful.
Have you ever gotten to the point where you've started to, like, codify laughter? Do you have names that you have for different kinds of laughers or for different kinds of laughs?
What an interesting concept. There's the Hamburg.
It seems to me the vaudevillians really had that. You know, there's the Boffo and there's... I've heard old vaudevillians talk that
way. I know all of them. I've never named them. I've never named them. I know what it's like. Oh... I go for those biggies. I like compliments that are normally peculiarly negative seemingly negative in result. For example, my cheeks hurt. I love that one. Oh, I tell you, my back is out of alignment from the laughter. I mean, someone pays the money and goes in and for an hour and 40 minutes, they're just hysterical laughing. and shaking their head, yes, I know that, yes. That's a beautiful thing. I tend to take it for granted sometime. I remember when I was on Broadway last and they're playing our song and we got our applause. And Lucy Arnaz, my co-star, I saw her eyes would glow, and the cast, who had very small parts, the chorus kind of, eyes would absolutely light up, and they were in their glory. Well, I get that all the time, and I'm the only one on the stage. I almost take it for granted.
As a comedian, you've both hosted and guested on The Carson Show and The Tonight Show lots of times. Did it take you a while to work up the proper couch behavior and everything when you're on The Tonight Show?
Yes. There is a definite technique. Rodney Dangerfield was very helpful to me early in my career when he was already becoming a little established. But, you know, when I first met him at the Improvisation Club in the fall of 66, I didn't do The Tonight Show until January of 68. It'll be my, is that 15th year? 17th year. That I'm doing it. It is not what it appears to be. You are not, talk shows were invented in order to present personalities, presumably celebrities, in a context in which you normally wouldn't see them. Esther Williams, instead of swimming, she sits on The Tonight Show. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. Well, you're not in someone's living room. You're in a television studio in front of millions of people with what really amounts to a proscenium arch with all kinds of deus ex machina. See, I didn't go to Yale for nothing. Stage devices and sets and all kinds of enhancements. And you only have a small amount of time. So where Johnny Mathis, who I like very much personally, over the years I've bumped into him now and again. I used to love his music an awful lot. He's very talented. He goes on, he tells a story about his dog, and everyone laughs. Well, a comedian has to go on with different standards. More is expected. So you must go on with the technique. And I sometimes don't do a stand-up. I've been established there for a long time, so they don't have to do one every time. But Rodney talked me into doing them more often, and he's right. Grab that time. But when you sit down on the panel, the best thing to do, you don't depend on some little subject you've discussed with a pre-interviewer, and Johnny will talk. Get some stuff ready. Do some stand-up sitting down. Be impactful. Get those laughs. And your job as an actor is to make those little conversational things look like little conversational things when they're really prepared ideas. So there is a couch technique, particularly for comedians who have the toughest go on any of those shows because there are the people right there. The talk shows do not sweeten laughter. If you don't get the laughs, it's quite obvious to everyone that you don't. The hardest there ever was in that area was the Ed Sullivan Show, which I did do six times. In addition to having to sidestep a bear act in the wings before the animals, you know, are fed, they eventually separated the animals and taped them. You'd go out in front of an audience that can barely see you. Cameramen and technicians are busy. Sullivan is talking to the producer, Bob Precht, in between acts while you're on. It's hard to get their attention. And comedians were known to do fair there. I got by pretty well in my six shots, but that was a real tough one. You are standing there. There's no chance to increase the sound of the laughter. As you know, the famous laugh machine, Woody Allen finally, someone finally showed it, I think Woody, in one of his movies, in first working with that machine in my summer show in 1970, I was so against it. But they said, we have to do this episodically, like cinema. We've got to cut. We have a very complicated sketches and all this, and then we have the laugh machine come in. And I said, oh, I hated it. And when they bring this expert in from California, the machine flies first class with him, strapped to a seat. It's in an old typewriter case. It was a brilliant invention that no one else could duplicate. It was locked, padlocked, and no one knew how to operate it or how to build it but him and his assistant. And don't you think I became a pig? I'm putting laughter to some of our sketches and some of my jokes. Give it a 10. What, are you kidding?
I really hate laugh machines when I'm watching television.
Yeah, but you, believe me, even as a media person, I mean, I say that at least some of the time you can be fooled. And the definitive research on this particular subject was done by your patron, public television, which really did discover that when you're watching something comedic and if there's pure silence, unless it's a film or something like that, it really hurts. And so it's seeking that happy medium. There are ways of doing things live, and I've subsequently done it, much of it live, and maybe a little business of sweetening. When you're on one of those talk shows and you're standing there, there's no chance for that. You're standing there and the test is made. And most of these shows, even the best of the sitcoms, if they have to redo something at 9 at night and the audience is gone already, they will sweeten it. You'll never know.
What do you think of that portion in the couch shows and the talk shows like that where the next guest walks out and has to kiss everybody, or you walk out and there's already two people on the couch and you have to lean over and kiss them?
It's entirely too much kissing. I mean, as a matter of fact, I have a bit about that. Did you know that?
No.
I have a piece about that, which I often do. I say, there's much too much kissy-poo on television. We don't know each other. Everybody in show business doesn't know everyone else. Does every plumber know everyone else? Does every major general know every... and yet there's all this, like, how are you, darling? Who are you? Why are you kissing me? And being a liberated man, which I think, Terry, you can tell is true. I mean, it's quite obvious. I'm liberal is all over. Liberated is all over, written all over my face. Ask my wife. Lauren Hutton, who is a beautiful model, an actress, was on. I put out my hand to shake her hand. I had met her a couple of times at New York parties. She told me she really admired my work. I told her I'm glad that she has a space between her teeth, since I just spent $1,500 to close mine, you know. I put out my hand to shake her hand. Just my luck. Who gave me a tremendous soul kiss? Dr. Joyce Brothers. I mean, really, Terry. And Bobby, baby, you know, Joyce, what are you doing? And she's very hip, though. We had the dream sequence. What do you do when Joyce Brothers is on? Next, Dr. Brothers analyzes dreams. Gene Hackman told his dream. It was a Merv show or something. Lauren Hutton told her dream, and I told the recurring dream I've had for 15 years of hot dogs chasing donuts through the Lincoln Tunnel. And Dr. Joyce Brothers, who cannot be fooled and is pretty hip, told me I was hungry. That's sort of the routine. I don't like it. I think a lot of it is false. But you know something? Even though I'm in a certain... in that Night of 100 Stars, for example, people like Joan Collins, whose work I've never seen. I've never seen Dynasty, whichever one she's on. She's sort of inching to the front to get the best picture for the finale with some little Asian makeup man following her around, her every move and all. And here I am with a couple of other sensible people in show business, probably not as sensible show business-wise, who are being more modest and... if they get our picture, right, fine. It's still a wonderful, certainly for me, way of making a living, a great profession, and by and large no worse than others. Excesses and drugs and alcoholism and divorce, I'm not sure would really exceed the rates of other professions. I think there's a lot of people who, from a Meryl Streep to who I think of, for example, lives unconventionally for a movie star, a little bit in upstate New York, has a family, cares about her family. I mean, Blythe Danner, who's a wonderful actress, she has to lug kids back and forth and here, and I know what that's like. And they're calm and intelligent about their art, their craft, and their fame. They're not overwhelmed with themselves. And there are a lot more people like that in show business than ever before. Sensible people, I think.
That was comedian Robert Klein, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air.